You're obviously really good at this.
Yeah, every time I send out a newsletter, I get 3 to 5 waitlist signups.
You're such like a entrepreneurial bootstrap kind of guy. When did you like really start doing this?
I haven't taken a marketing class ever. I've been posting content for close to 7 years, if not more than that now. It's pretty hard not to win.
If there's any advice you would leave the audience with about competing in the attention economy,
you don't want to post generic fluff that anyone else could post. That video got 1.6 million views.
Damn. Why do you think that hit so well?
It's such a simple answer.
Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. Today, we're speaking with Tommy Clark. He's a B2B social media expert and has been producing content in a professional creator capacity for himself for at least half a decade. First as a nutrition coach on YouTube, and then as a B2B social guy on YouTube again and with a newsletter. And I actually interviewed him for another newsletter 2 years ago. But he's done a lot since then, so I'm excited to catch up. So, Tommy, the biggest thing you've done since we last talked is start a content agency. When I last talked to you, you were the head of social at Triple Whale, a SaaS brand. Now you've got this agency, Compound. Tell me about that. What is Compound? What do you guys do?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you dug deep to find the nutrition coach thing. Kudos to you on the research there. That is definitely a past life. But with
45,000 views on some of those videos, I mean, come on.
It's so funny. They did kind of pop off. Like if you really want to find them on YouTube, they're not that hard to find, unfortunately. But we're just letting it ride. But to answer your question, with the agency, the one sentence pitch is we create LinkedIn content for B2B founders. A lot of the people we work with are B2B software founders. But really the playbook applies whether you're in software, a service. If your customer's on LinkedIn, like, we'll help you get in front of them.
Yeah. Why did you, so you were at Triple Whale for a little over a year. I don't think you, did you even have like another kind of full-time job in the field before that? You're such like a entrepreneurial bootstrap kind of guy. Was it kind of just like you did that and you were like, I don't want to be an employee anymore. I want to do my own thing. And then you decided to start the agency. Like, why did you decide to start the agency rather than another full-time role?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's two things. One is that I already knew from the beginning that I wanted to do my own thing at some point. I think I imagined it would take longer than it did. I was sort of thinking 5 or 10 years versus 1.5. And two, it kind of just happened by accident. So how it played out was I had my full-time job. And then because Triple Whale was so successful, not like kind of a humble brag, I guess, but we did have some success on social. I started getting a lot of inbound from other companies asking like, hey, do you do any consulting? Do you do any freelance work? And I had time on nights and weekends without kind of impacting what I was doing in my day to day. So I was like, yeah, why not? Like, let me get the reps in. Let me see if I can get some more results and case studies. And then from there, over the course of 5 or 6 months, kind of accidentally built up this client roster. And then it got to a point where I was like, okay, I have these clients. I have this full-time job. I have no time left. Something has to give. And going back to what I was saying a second ago, I already knew I wanted to do my own thing at some point. So I figured, okay, I have this kind of sitting in my lap right now. I'd be kind of stupid not to take it and run with it and see where we go.
Yeah. So now you have a team around you. Kind of, it sounds like you started getting all this work and then it was like, okay, I got too much work. I need help. Let me hire somebody. How long did it take to like getting to that first hire? Who was that first hire? I'm really interested in like, because this is your first time building a team.
How long did it take? It took way too long. I should have hired way earlier. Every time anyone asks me about this, I'm like, as soon as you think you need to make a hire, just hire. You will not regret it. So I left Triple Whale end of Q3 in 2023. At that point, I had already had a operations manager on a contract basis that was kind of helping me with some of the admin and logistics of posting client content and all of the repetitive things that I just didn't have a ton of time for and quite frankly didn't want to do. So I was already hiring out a bit for that side of things, but I was so terrified to hire out for the content side of things because up until that
point,
that's
your magic
clients,
touch, like,
yeah, that was like what I was good at. And I think I still am pretty good at, and I was hesitant that I wouldn't be able to find someone who could produce content at the level that I could. So for the next 3 to 4 months, we very quickly hit capacity again. So I left Triple Whale, announced that I left, got flooded with inbound, and then very quickly again hit that point where I just didn't have any bandwidth left. I probably stretched myself a bit too thin, and it was fine for, I would say, 2.5 months, and then the cracks started to show. I was getting burnt out, but I was still terrified to hire. And I probably waited another 2 months after that before I pulled the trigger and hired my head of content.
Okay.
I should have hired the head of content as soon as I knew I wanted to build the agency. If someone's listening to this and is considering starting an agency or going the freelance route, my biggest piece of advice is pick which one you want to do. Mm-hmm. If you want to be a freelancer, absolutely nothing wrong with that. You can make really good money as a freelancer, keep all the profit. It's fantastic. But just be aware that you're going to hit your capacity and you have to respect that. Like, you're not going to be able to push past a certain point besides increasing your prices. But if you want to build an agency, which I can get into like why I chose that route in a second. But if you want to go that route, just start building the team and systems from day one, because you're going to need them at some point. And the longer you delay that, the more painful it is. And the more you're going to wish that you just did it earlier. Yeah. So that would be my advice there.
Okay. How big? So I want to get into the content side of things in a second, because ostensibly this is, you know, about you as a creator. But how big is the team now, actually?
Yeah, we're 8 full time. We'll likely be at 9 or 10 in the next 1 to 2 months. We're looking for writers. So if you're a content writer and you love content, but you want to work at an agency and get some reps in, hit me up.
Honestly, I'm sure
that will be my plug at the end of the episode.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a few listeners probably who might take you up on that. Okay, let's talk about the newsletter though. So you have a newsletter now called Social Files. You use Beehive, but you started it 4 years ago, I think October 2020, I believe. And it was on Substack, and it was called Tommy Talks Marketing. So to me, like from the outside, looks like there's about like 3 chapters here. You're on Substack for like 2 years, like a year and a half. And then I think you got hired by Triple Whale and maybe took a break. And then you were doing it, name change. It's called Social Files, and you were part of Workweek, this network. And then you leave Workweek about a year ago or so, and you're back independent on Beehive again. So does that track? Like, are those kind of 3 distinct chapters?
Yeah, that tracks.
Okay, cool. I guess, like, you know, you probably started the newsletter like so many people did. It was 2020. Newsletters are hot. You're like, you know, you're trying to like learn and put yourself out there, and you're like kind of a natural like creator type, like just putting yourself out there. But I do want to talk about the Workweek era. You are the second person I've had on this who joined and then later left Workweek. The first was Brett Duszewski of Healthcare Huddle. So tell me about kind of the decision to join that and then the decision to leave.
Yeah, no, great question. I mean, I have nothing but good things to say about my time there. Adam and Becca and the rest of the team, and Brett was probably my main point of contact there, actually, when I was part of that network, and he's amazing as well. So started the newsletter in the pre-Workweek era, just as a way to sort of share what I was learning about marketing. At that time, it was more about networking and potentially getting a job versus getting customers or clients or even really growing an audience.
And it worked.
So did that. It worked amazing. I got my job at Triple Whale off of a cold Twitter DM that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been posting content or writing about stuff or making videos and all of that. Mm-hmm. But was doing that, got hired at Triple Whale. And then a friend of mine, Daniel Murray, who runs the Marketing Millennials LinkedIn page, and they have a massive audience over there. He's
like a million.
Yeah. So I forget how we connected. I think it was through Twitter somehow, but we both moved to Austin around the same time, started chatting, became friends. He was super supportive and actually connected me with Adam, and they were looking to bring someone in to Workweek to write about social media strategy.
Okay.
And at this time, I think I had like 500 subscribers on the Tommy Talks Marketing newsletter.
So after like it was 2 years.
It was very small. Yeah, for like 2 years. I wasn't really actively trying to grow it. It was just kind of there as like a resume of sort. Yeah, pretty much. I had a few pieces that gained a little bit of traction here and there, but nothing crazy at all. But the quality of the writing was good. And Daniel saw that. Adam saw that. And I chatted with Adam and Becca. They offered to bring me into Workweek. And really the decision was, I mean, they have a great team. They know what they're doing when it comes to growing newsletters. I knew the quality of my newsletter was good, but I didn't really know how to grow it. And I also just didn't have time to, because at that time I had my full-time job.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm writing this. I'm going to keep writing it regardless of if it grows or not. It's just too good of an opportunity to say no to. And they were willing to take a bet on me early, which I really appreciate. And that really got the content side of things going. So I'll pause there. Any questions on that part before I get into like the decision to leave, that side of things?
I'm curious, like basically, so if you were at like at 500 when you joined, I'm curious first where you were when you ended, how big the audience was.
Yeah, I think the audience was around, really around where it is right now, around like 16 to 17,000. So it was a combination of organic, Twitter, LinkedIn, and then they also put quite a bit of paid spend behind it, which is one of the like arrangements as part of being in the network, was like they would use their resources to help grow the newsletter with paid, which was another reason I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like, let's do this and get this in front of more people. So yeah, grew quite a bit between those. I think it was 2 years or so.
The trade-off, if I remember when I was talking to Brett, he was saying that like basically you get, as a creator in the network, you get kind of a set fee and then they do the advertising and stuff. So like any, like you get, you know, a fair fee, but any upside they're then taking in, right?
Yeah, for sure. So like the win-win side of it is like, okay, I get this flat fee, I get a percentage of the ad spend, but they also pocketed a good chunk of the ad spend to make it worth their time. So
yeah that's which it's really interesting to me that, like, you know, there's a few people who've come in and out. Like, it seems like, I don't know. And Brett too is like, only good things to say. Just like, you know, I couldn't commit so much time to it in the way that like I had to justify being part of it. I need to have Adam on this, I think, at some point, to get into all that, but yeah. Okay. So decision to leave, why, what happens there?
Yeah. I mean, the short answer is that the best way to monetize my newsletter was through the agency, not necessarily through ad sales. And that's pretty much it. It's like, we weren't selling a ton of ads and it didn't make sense for them to keep trying to sell ads and like try to make that work. But it was really good for lead gen and for the agency. So it really just made more sense for both parties. Like, okay, I'm going to use this as a media property for the agency to get leads there. And then like, yeah, that's pretty much it. So nothing like super complex, very like amicable. And it was like, honestly, the best move for both of us. But that was pretty much the TLDR there.
That makes sense. So leads, is the newsletter where you've gotten the majority of the leads? Cause you have like a pretty big, I think you're like 30,000 on LinkedIn, pretty decent on Twitter too. I forget. Is the newsletter where you're getting a lot of the leads for the agency, or is it the social platforms? Where are the most leads coming from and the best leads for the agency?
Yeah, every time I send out a newsletter, I get 3 to 5 waitlist signups. And for a high ticket service like ours, that's fantastic. So most of the time, the funnel looks like this. They'll find us through LinkedIn. They'll subscribe to my newsletter. They'll be indoctrinated by my newsletter weekly. And I also have like a 30-day sequence built out in Beehive that just, they get a piece of value from me pretty much every day. And it's just such a good way to build trust with that potential buyer. So yeah, the newsletter is one of the main channels where like we're driving traffic. So before it was LinkedIn and Twitter. Honestly, Twitter right now has not been amazing for us. It's very quickly switched over to mainly LinkedIn as the top of funnel traffic source. And then they'll subscribe to my newsletter. And yeah, like I said, every time I send out an edition of the newsletter, I'll get anywhere from 3 to 5 waitlist signups. And it's pretty much kept us at or near capacity, going back to when we first started the agency.
Yeah, super nice. Okay, a tangent for a second. 2 days ago, you had this tweet. Twitter has devolved from being a core part of our marketing strategy to being a stream of consciousness for my ideas that won't pop on LinkedIn or IG. Tell me about that devolution. You were kind of just touching on it.
Honestly, the content's just not performing as well anymore. And the effort that it takes to get a piece of content to perform well on Twitter in like a niche specific, like business relevant way. Yeah. It's not just mainstream political drama or rage bait or super, super top of funnel stuff that's not even remotely related to your business. It's pretty difficult right now. Unless you're doing these like paid promotion type of things, which I don't even want to get into. It's just like kind of black hat, like I'll pay you to retweet my thing. It's like, okay, maybe it works for some people, but not a game that I really want to play. Without that, it's really hard to grow organically right now. And even when a post does perform well, the translation into link clicks or even follows is so low that it would take so many posts performing so well for you to even see an impact from the platform. And the way I like to pick my social platforms is what is going to get you the most output for the least input. So LinkedIn is great for that right now because it does take effort to write a good LinkedIn post, but it's pretty straightforward. If you have a good hook and the content quality is good, especially if you're good on video right now, they're really indexing on that. It's pretty hard not to grow on LinkedIn. If you're posting once or twice a day, you're commenting and engaging, you're going to grow on the platform and you're going to get in front of the right type of people. Instagram, I would say, is harder, But when you get it right, there's a lot more upside. Like if you get a million views on an Instagram video, that's going to translate for sure into followers. You'll likely drive some link clicks. A few of my friends right now are really doing well on Instagram for their newsletter growth and their businesses. So that's also promising. I still think LinkedIn for a B2B agency is the no-brainer. Well,
that's your whole brand best
platform. Exactly. And we use it. We use our own strategy. To answer your original question, Twitter has a special place in my heart. I still use it because I like it and it's fun. But from a business perspective, it's not great right now. Could that change in the future? Like if you're watching this in 2025, maybe. I hope so. I'd be very happy if it did. But I don't know. Right now, it's tough.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, so one more thing on Twitter. When I was looking back at the last interview we did, which was published August 2022, you mentioned how your kind of greatest hit and your most successful post was this one. And I went back and read it, this thread about how Minions, The Rise of Gru had like killed it on social and the box office and like the relationship between those two things. So that was 2 years ago. I was wondering if you have any like greatest hits, whether on Twitter or LinkedIn or the newsletter or whatever, any like greatest hits since then that have just killed it for you in the same way that you were thinking of that as a greatest hit.
Oh man. The one that comes to mind actually isn't on LinkedIn or Twitter. It's on Instagram. Recently, there was like a 1 week run earlier this year where I had four or five videos really pop. The one that hit the most was, you know, that guy on Instagram, Davis Clark. He's like,
love Davis Clark.
Yes. So I did a short form video. Okay, this is going to be so random to anyone who has zero context around this, but he ran a marathon and like PR got sub-3. After the race is over, he takes an Instagram, like a selfie Instagram reel video, and there's shit running down his leg. And again, this is going to make no sense to anyone without context.
You got to look up Davis Clark. Look him up on Instagram if you're listening to this. You don't know who he is.
Yes.
It's pretty funny.
It's hilarious. And then Dude Wipes, the like wipes brand, is in the comments making jokes, and they're like active on Twitter, jumping into any of the conversation around it. Masterclass in social listening and community engagement. So I make a short form video going over what happened, the strategy, how Dude Wipes executed this so well. And that video got, I think it's at 1.6 million views right now.
Damn.
And that I think was the biggest hit in terms of like virality. More recently on LinkedIn, the short form video side of things has been pretty cracked out. And I've had a few videos hit 1 million or 1.5 million. The impressions numbers on LinkedIn are a little bit sketchy. I wouldn't value those the same as I would value a 1.5 million on Instagram. I think they're still figuring out their stuff when it comes to short form video. Very promising. But yeah, greatest hit was that like Davis Clark short form video. Then I had a few other ones that hit 500K, 600K, just all in like a week span. The problem was it did nothing for my business. And we're super busy right now at the agency. So I was like, okay, this is cool. Quite the dopamine hit, but this is a total distraction at this point in time.
Was it a matter of like timing? Like that video had just been posted and you did it like a day later. And then so like that's kind of why the algorithm coalesced around that. And then maybe it was like a few other videos in like the trail of that. And then it trailed off. Like, why do you think that hit so well?
Yeah. So that video, I think I did it. It was within a week of his video going live. Yeah. So kind of similar to that Minions Twitter thread. It was very much a trend jacking video. It was for sure top of funnel because people outside of marketing and business know Davis Clark. It's like mainstream Instagram users.
He has like a million followers or something right now.
Yeah. Yes. If you're just watching Instagram for as like brain rot after work, you're going to know who Davis Clark is. Probably. Like, obviously, there's some people that don't, but pretty likely that a lot of people will. So that with the trend of that video having gone live a week before, I think contributed to it doing well. If I would have posted that same video now, for example, it might have done decent, but it wouldn't have done as well as it did. The other video that week that really crushed was this video detailing Mark Zuckerberg's PR strategy.
Oh, yeah.
I think this was when the gold chain meme
the debut.
Yeah. Yeah. So when that meme was going around and everyone was like, whoa, what happened to Zucks? Like, he used to look like an alien. Now he's like cool and stylish. What's going on here? I did a video on that and how that tied into founder-led branding. Mm-hmm. And that one did pretty well. And then there was another one that I did on a sponsorship that Ramp did in the Masters. which was actually during that weekend. So that was also a timely one. So I think the common thread is if you can find a topic that's relevant to you and your niche and is timely that a lot of people are talking about, that is by far the easiest way to get virality relatively predictably. It's harder because you have to be on it and it's not as evergreen. So it can turn into a bit of a treadmill, which is honestly why I didn't really keep that going because it didn't really make sense for my business at the time. But yeah, I think that's like the lesson there in terms of content strategy.
Yeah, that makes sense. So one more thing, when I was talking to you last time and looking back at the interview, I asked you how much time you were spending on Tommy Clark stuff as opposed to Triple Whale full-time job stuff. And you said you basically spent like 5 or 6 hours every Sunday working on your own content. So I'm curious how that's changed because now it's like, you know, you run a company, but you still make this like just Tommy content, but it's lead gen for your business. So I don't know if there like is a demarcation there. Tell me about like the relationship between Tommy as a brand and Compound as a company.
Yeah, it's interesting. So there's definitely a lot. It's a lot closer of a relationship now, obviously, since my content is lead gen for my company. But there still is a pretty clear demarcation. Reason being is that fortunately, like I said, we're in a position where lead gen really isn't the bottleneck for us. Like we have a wait list. It's a great problem to have, but it's still a problem that I'm trying to solve. And as such, like a lot of my focus has had to go towards hiring and recruiting and training and all the ops stuff that's sort of on the back end. So I would actually say that the split between the time that's spent on that and like client work and my own content is actually still pretty similar. I'll do about an hour or two a day, two on the high end, but most likely an hour, hour and a half of my own content, whether it be my newsletter or social content, usually in the morning. And I'll still do on the weekend, usually Sunday, a sort of larger block of focus time on my own content. And that's usually enough to get me what I need for the next week or 2 weeks to where I'm not really struggling for content output. And it leaves me plenty of time to make sure clients are happy, make sure my team's happy, do all the hiring stuff, sales calls, all the other things that add up. So I would say I'm still definitely that like creator operator hybrid. And it's tempting to go more and more in that creator direction. But right now, more time spent on content isn't necessarily going to be what's going to drive growth for our business now.
Do you have any like goals for like your personal content and your personal brand, whatever? Do you have any goals against that you're working with other than just like lead gen for the business? Or is that it?
Honestly, no. At the end of the day, it's like, I want to get customers. I've thought about this a lot and I go back and forth, but for me personally, building the agency as like its own business and having that run and be able to run eventually, like without me being the bottleneck, is just a lot more appealing to me than solely being a creator. There's no right or wrong answer there. But like for me personally, that's the route that I'm going. So whether I have 10,000 followers or 100, if it's driving leads for the agency and we're in a good spot there, I'm good. Now, do I generally want to get from, say, 30,000 on LinkedIn to 50? Sure. Whether that happens in Q4 or like end of next year doesn't really matter to me if we're in a good spot with the agency. That said, it's like I know content is driving leads and pretty much all our leads that aren't referrals for the agency. So it's a major focus. It's just not so much on getting to a certain number of followers or driving brand deals, which might be the case for other creators.
Yeah. So let's talk about money for a second. You were about to touch on that. We don't have to get into like specific details. You know, I'm not going to make you divulge your tax returns, but a few things. One, how long did it take you to replace your full-time Triple Whale salary once you started doing the freelancing into the agency?
So I was actually making more from freelance stuff than my salary when I left.
And like already before you left?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Which was part of the reason why I left when I did. Honestly, I'm pretty risk averse, I would say. Like, I'm not one of the burn the boats, like, go all in, no options like type of people.
Yeah.
So I probably stayed longer than I needed to. Honestly, I loved the job. It was so much fun. And
you were good.
Even when I left, it was so fun. And even now, being a CEO is very different than being a social media manager. Better in some ways and not so much so in other ways. It was a fun job and I didn't really want to necessarily get out as quickly as possible. Then also on the financial side, like I was I definitely skewed more to the side of, hey, I'd rather make sure I'm in a good spot here before I make this jump than the whole put your back against the wall, burn the boats, that sort of mentality. And again, no right or wrong answer, but that's just what worked for me.
It worked well. Are there any you've never really had like a full like creator business model where you're like monetizing through like ads and like sponsorships and videos, etc. But I don't know. I'm curious, like the way you were just talking about being so risk adverse, it sounds like there's a reason for that because that is kind of so hard and risky and hard to uphold. I'm curious if there's any like kind of creator first business models out there that you admire or think are like really smart, even if you don't practice them.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the one that comes to mind that I think is just crushing it right now is Oren John, like on Instagram, on pretty much any platform. Like when I look at people who I would like to emulate in terms of their content strategy and like how they're approaching things, I think this is the answer for a lot of people, but I think he is doing really, really well. And that's not surprising. My good friend Alex Garcia runs Marketing Examined, and he's also doing an amazing job. They kind of do a hybrid of ad sales and some services stuff. I think those are the two that come to mind that are doing really well right now that I look to and think like their content is really high quality and have a super interesting business model.
That makes sense. Okay, so since we last spoke, I think the B2B creator landscape has really exploded. That's obviously like how entirely how you make your money is like contributing to that and helping it explode, which so obviously that growth is good for your bottom line. But has the increased saturation presented any challenges for like either the work you do personally with like, you know, your personal brand stuff or with your clients? Or is it just kind of, you know, more for everybody?
Honestly, not really. I haven't thought about it that much. If you're good at what you do, you'll be fine. That's my mentality when it comes to it. We're so busy, and not even just from like we have enough clients, but just things are so busy right now that I haven't had time to think about what anyone else is doing. So it's just not really a concern to me. And honestly, like I think it's just more helpful and more productive to turn that focus inward and just get really good at your craft. And like I said, if you're good at what you do, if you're good at what you do and you give a good client experience, or if you're working like a more traditional creator model and your sponsors are getting good returns or getting a good experience, like you're going to be in a good spot. So I don't really pay any attention.
That makes sense. So you're obviously really good at this, like what you just said, you're not really worrying about it, et cetera. You have no problem getting clients, you're putting out all this content, you've got all these systems, et cetera. I wonder if you could tell me like what type of person isn't good at this, or like what kind of traits, you know, in a person like don't help with this. I think the posting life isn't really for everybody. And I think it's good to like caution people, like, look, if you can't hack X, Y, Z, whatever, you're not good at it. Like, what do you think? I don't know. Maybe what's necessary to succeed in the poster's life? And then maybe what will really get in the way of success?
You just have to like it and enjoy it. I love this stuff. It's such a simple answer, and it's not fancy. It's not some hack or tip or trick, but it's probably the single biggest thing, whether it's someone like me or our clients. I've gotten to the point now where I have a team around me and maybe I don't have to be as chronically online. I still probably am more than most people. But when you go back to that time at Triple Whale or before that, or even like during like the nutrition coach fitness business days, I was just binge watching any like Gary Vee video I could, or reading any article I could, being on and the Instagram timeline. Yeah, and just applying it right away. I haven't taken a marketing class ever. My degree is in applied nutrition. I also thought I was going to be a doctor at some point. Like I haven't studied this traditionally ever. But I really enjoyed it. And I just went super deep down the rabbit hole. And it was kind of during that COVID period where I had nothing else to do besides coast through online classes and just work on stuff. That I just went super deep down the rabbit hole and really immersed myself in it. And again, now I'm at a point where I can build systems and build a team and again, not have to be as attached to the timeline all the time. But there is going to be that period early where you just have to get a ridiculous amount of reps in. And it's just kind of the price you have to pay.
Well, I want to talk about this early period. So I know, I think the nutrition videos I found, maybe they were as far back as 2018, whatever. But I'm curious, like, even before that, like, were you like 13 making like YouTube lip sync videos, whatever it is? Like, when did you like really start doing this?
No, I definitely wasn't one of those like child creators. I started, I think it was the second half of my freshman year of college. So it was in 2018. It was right around the time when I got super into the health and fitness world. So like I said, I actually wanted to be a doctor. I was getting a biology major. And then somehow, I think it's because I was playing basketball and I got super into sports nutrition and that whole world. And then I started helping my friends out with their diets, and that was decently successful. And then I was like, oh, you can actually build a business around this thing. Cool. Like, I want to start doing that. And then I started doing that as a side hustle in college. And that was my first exposure to content, because I had to get clients for it outside of just my immediate friends and family. And I saw that everyone had an Instagram. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go create an Instagram for this. And that's when I started watching all of Gary Vee's stuff and other like marketing thought leaders and whatever to learn how to use those platforms. But yeah, it definitely wasn't a super, super early thing in my childhood, but probably earlier than most. I think I was around 18 years old.
And looking back too, it's like, it's quality. You were putting the effort in. So speaking of like all the systems, and now, you know, you've built all these systems within the business, and I'm sure like for your personal flow as well. Do you use AI at all in your production process besides for interview transcripts, or is it kind of just like, I don't need that, doesn't really help?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the interview transcripts are probably the biggest use of it we have right now. And then I've been playing around with some tools on the content production side and ideation side. I've used ChatGPT occasionally, Claude occasionally.
Yeah.
Actually building a SaaS product coming soon. I can't say too much about it
yet. I know. I did see some teaser tweets.
This is coming soon. And it is in that category. And it actually is very good. I can't say too much about it yet. So I hate to like do the whole cliffhanger thing. But I think my co-founder will kill me. Have been using that quite a bit in our content workflow, and I can share more about that in the future.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you don't have to tell me what this thing is, but how long have you been working on this SaaS thing? I want to know anything you could give me. Like, is it like, you know, like 3 months ago you met this person, you started talking about this thing, you're like, wait, we have to do this. Like, why are you starting a SaaS business?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Been working on it for a few months. My co-founder been working on it for quite some time before that. And then we connected. It's a great fit. The product made sense. I had had the itch to get into the SaaS game, but I just had no bandwidth to do it as a solo founder. And I wasn't really actively trying to get into it. But the co-founder fit was really strong and the product was high quality. And I was looking to someone to support on the marketing side, which is obviously like my game. And selfishly, I wanted to be able to run a marketing motion for a company without
really no layers,
client approval, no layers, just me. I can do whatever I want, full creative freedom. It's very fun. And I haven't had that in a while. I mean, aside from the agency. So that's sort of how it came to be.
All right. I won't push you on it more. Okay. I heard in another interview that you don't use social scheduling tools with clients, which I know like my old boss at a previous job, Ari, he, you know him, he has the same philosophy. He's, you know, just he write it in the platform, publish it in the platform. You get in the mindset, I don't know, superstition about like the algorithm not liking scheduled, whatever. So you don't use social scheduling tools. Does that create any complications when you're putting out like 200 pieces of content a week?
Yes and no. So we have someone on our team whose job it is literally to go through our client content and
post everything,
make sure it goes live and it's all good to go. He's a part-time content coordinator. He's amazing. Absolute lifesaver. We've built out that motion so we don't have to rely on a social scheduling tool. That said, if you need to schedule your content, it's not going to make or break anything. Like I think the reason why it tends to work better when you go in and post your own stuff is just because you're online to engage. Whether or not the scheduler tool affects the actual performance of the post, platforms will tell you it doesn't. It's hard to tell. I don't think it's enough to really worry about it. And this is probably one of the things that I've changed my mind on a bit in the past 2-3 years. Just because now like running a company, I see that, oh, maybe it's not feasible to just expect yourself to be able to go in like whenever and post all this content. So if it's going to help you be more consistent and get stuff out there, use it. my warning or my recommendation, if you are going to use a scheduler tool, is make sure you're still going in and replying to comments, engaging with other people proactively. Because if you're just going to put it in your scheduler, send it off, and never log in to LinkedIn or Twitter or Instagram or whatever platform you're using, then you're not going to grow just because you're not involved in the platform, in the community. But I'm not sure anymore if it's like really the tool that's responsible for that.
Yeah, it's more about just how much are you paying attention.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, I'm wondering if you have any, I'm sure, I don't know if you have like a list, you probably don't, but any like posting rules, posters code, one of which like would be, you know, I've heard you say like post every day. If you want to grow, you have to post every day, etc. I don't know, any like kind of baseline rules you operate by in how you, you know, post and create content for social media.
Yeah, I mean, I'll start with the cadence. Like you mentioned, I would post daily or as close to daily as you can. With LinkedIn in particular, I'd recommend 5 to 7 times per week. So one time per day, either on weekdays or just every day. Weekends can actually work pretty well. Doesn't matter a ton if you don't do it, but as close to daily as possible would be ideal. LinkedIn is interesting, actually, in that if you post too much, it can actually hurt your performance. So you're not going to really want to post more than twice in a day, unless it's for a very specific reason or if you have like a specific strategy around it.
Yeah,
exactly. Maybe a big launch, but generally one time per day is sufficient. As far as the actual post, the most important thing is the idea. Like if the idea is not good, it's not going to do well, no matter how you package it, no matter what little hacks or tactics you use, the idea has to be strong. And if you're a founder, or even if you're not a founder, if you're like a creator or an employee that wants to post more on LinkedIn and grow your personal brand, lean on your own individual stories. Mm-hmm. You don't want to post generic fluff that anyone else could post. Like you should be able to look at your post without looking at the profile picture or the name and be able to confidently say that like, hey, this post could only come from
me. Have a clear point of view.
Exactly. Have a clear point of view. Use your own experiences and anecdotes to support your takes. So like, for example, if I'm telling you, like we were talking about a second ago, my thoughts on social media scheduler tools and the approach there, a bad version of the hook or an okay version that might pass some people's filter but isn't actually very good is 3 things to consider when it comes to picking your social media scheduler
tool. When it comes is my least favorite. Never say when it comes to.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. But anyone could post that. That could be an output from ChatGPT.
Yeah.
But compare that to a story about a conversation that I was having with a client yesterday who asked me this question. Or this is super meta, but tomorrow morning I could write that, hey, was on a podcast yesterday and the host asked me like what I thought about scheduler tools. Like, here's what I think when what I see with clients.
Yeah.
Like, that's a much more compelling post. It still covers the same idea. But that can only come from me. No one else is sitting in this chair right now that could like write that post. Now, a more extreme version of this and one style of post that you see work very well is like if you're a founder who had some massive exit. So say you sold your company for $10 million or $50 million. Using that in your hook and like sharing lessons from that experience, obviously a lot more compelling than someone sharing 10 business building lessons who has never done anything like that. So the more that you can lean into your own experiences and get specific, the better the post is going to be. Now, once you have that idea, you want to make sure the hook is strong. So the post could be really good, but if those first 1 to 3 lines are not, you're kind of screwed. Yeah. So you want to put extra effort into those first 1 to 3 lines. Think of it the same way that a YouTuber thinks of their title and thumbnail. Mm-hmm. Like you've heard Mr. Beast or Ali Abdaal say that the packaging, that title and thumbnail, most important part of a video. If that flops, doesn't matter how good the rest of the video was, no one's watching.
Yeah.
Same thing with your LinkedIn content. The meat of the post could be fantastic, but if no one clicks see more because that first 1 to 3 lines is not good, doesn't really matter. So I'll pause there, but if you nail the idea and the hook, you're probably 90% of the way there.
Yeah. Okay. So one thing that I think is core, I understand is core to the way you guys operate is these like founder interviews, which is kind of how you get this content that you're describing here, where it's like only I can write this. This seems to me like a core of what you guys do at Compound is you have these kind of like templatized lists of questions that you're probably often tweaking, adding to, whatever. And that's how you get probably like the bulk of the content you guys produce, right? Is you're doing these interviews with founders and like, because it can be the same question, but it's going to get the different answer. And that's how you get these people to like spill, because they've got the stories in there, but they're just not going to sit down and write it. So it's like, this is kind of, you know, the core of how you guys operate, right? These like 15, 20 minute calls where you're like, tell me about this time when you did X. And it's like the same question to all the clients, but a different answer. And that's kind of how you guys power the 200 plus posts per week.
Yeah, exactly. The bulk of what we write for clients is just stuff that's living in their own head that we then take and package. Yeah. The way I frame it to them is the stuff that we're producing for you should be the content that you would sit down and write anyway if you had the time or skill to do it on your own. So it's all the stuff that's living in their head. And yeah, we pretty much sit down like we're sitting down right now on this podcast interview, and I'll run them through the questions. Some are kind of constant across clients. Some are specific to the client. Yeah. If there's like a particular topic or something that's unique to them that we want to dive into. But using that allows us to get those examples and anecdotes that only they could post about. And then occasionally we'll do like our own research, or if we see an article or a trend that could be interesting. But even then, we'll ask the client for their commentary on it. So that piece is still unique to their experience and their thoughts versus being a more general piece.
Yeah, that makes sense. Just a few more questions. One, YouTube. So you've got, again, the old YouTube. It's got like a few thousand subscribers. Videos are doing pretty good.
And I'm sure it's still getting views. I haven't looked at it at all. I
haven't opened up YouTube Studio. No. But then you've got the newer one where you've been making videos for, I think, like the past 8 months, as you know, kind of an extension of what you write about in the newsletter. Tell me about the YouTube, and are you like scripting videos, et cetera? How are you approaching YouTube now, and how has it changed from when you were doing it a few years ago?
Yeah, honestly, the approach is actually pretty similar. The niche is very different. And right now, the way we're thinking about YouTube, I think of it more as lead nurture than a way for people to find us. That's going to change shortly. We actually just started working with a partner on YouTube. Still very early, so I can't really speak to any results there. But going to be a lot more of a focus in Q4. The classic big things coming. But up until this point, the way that I viewed YouTube and video in general is just a way for people to build trust with me at a much faster rate. So if someone can see me and hear me and kind of sit down kind of with for like a sort of conversation with me, they're going to build trust and know that I understand what I'm doing at a much faster rate than seeing a tweet or even a LinkedIn post or even like a newsletter to some degree. Like there's still like that missing ingredient in the written word.
You have more control over your character as it's presented.
Exactly. So YouTube has been great for us. And what happens a lot of the time is, like I was saying earlier, people will find us through LinkedIn and then either go to the newsletter or my YouTube or usually both. And by the time they've read my newsletter content and they've consumed my YouTube content, if they get on a sales call with me, they're already sold. Like they know our playbook.
That parasocial,
they know our language.
Relationship is there.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they get on the call, they feel like they know me because they kind of do. At least they know my thought process when it comes to social and content strategy. So it just makes that sales process so much easier. Now, the next stage for YouTube for us is going to be figuring out how to get new people to find us from YouTube. Mm-hmm. We're not really seeing that yet just because, honestly, I hadn't put that much time and effort into thumbnails and the whole packaging thing we were talking about a few minutes ago. Yeah. I hadn't put as much time and effort into that on YouTube. But even if you have 100 subscribers or 300 or 300, I think 380 or 67 like we do right now, you can still drive a lot of business just by nurturing the people that are finding you through other platforms like LinkedIn or Twitter or Instagram.
Just make a flywheel, as they always say. Okay. Last question. You've given a lot of good advice and such, but, if there's any advice you would leave the audience with about competing in the attention economy generally, or whether it's, you know, LinkedIn newsletter, maybe there's rules that cut across all of them. I don't know. Any advice that comes to mind?
There's a lot. The one that came to mind first is just keep going. I've been posting content for, I think it's close to 7 years, if not more than that now, which even that is not that long.
Yeah.
But you see a lot of people come and go when it comes to posting content. And if you can simply just keep going and keep publishing consistently for months and years, it's pretty hard not to win. And even during that time, you're going to have pivots. Like we were talking about with me, I started in the health and fitness category. Yeah. And then there was like a brief esports phase. And then I went to like marketing, B2B marketing. And
you had a podcast for like a year.
Yeah. And I think I found my spot. I don't think we're pivoting out of this anytime soon. But it takes some time to sort of find that niche that works for you and build that weird blend of skills that puts you in a unique position to win in that niche. Like I don't think I'd be winning how we are right now if I didn't have that experience in the health and fitness world and learning that original content strategy there. So that doesn't happen if I bow out a year in or even 2 years or 3 years in. And it's the same thing with business. I'm very quickly learning with building the agency. There was a period last year where I was so close to a breaking point. Like we were talking about earlier, before I made that first hire, I was like, I don't know if this is for me.
Yeah.
But I was actually talking to, you know, Marcus, who runs Minted New York.
Yeah.
So I was in New York. I think I'd just gone on a run with him. And I forget how this came up in a conversation. He was like, yeah, like number one piece of advice when it comes to like the business stuff is just like, just keep going. It's a war of attrition. And it's very much the same in that category and also just in the content game. If you can just keep posting for,
find a way,
say 5 years, 10 years, it's pretty unlikely that you're going to win unless you're just actively trying not to learn what's working and not.
Yeah.
Like if you're posting and you're implementing those trends that you're seeing or those learnings that are coming from it, you're going to be fine. So I think everything else is downstream of that, because if you're not consistent and you're not posting, you're just not going to learn anything and you're not going to grow.
Just keep posting. All right, that's it. What do you want to plug?
Yeah, so obviously got the agency going. If you're a B2B founder and you want help growing on LinkedIn, would love to chat and see if there's a fit. And then honestly, more importantly for us right now, if you're a writer or a creator that's listening to this and you're like, hey, I want to get some reps in, learn how to do this whole LinkedIn thing, the content writer position at our agency would probably be a great fit as for a more junior
person. If you've listened to this whole podcast, you're probably a good fit.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're looking for a role like that, would love to chat. My LinkedIn is probably the best way to get in touch with me. Yeah, that's all I've got. But really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, of course. This was great. You're a pro. All right. Yeah, this has been the Creator Spotlight Podcast. And listener, I will see you next week.